Moxon, reel 4.
I remember at one time I was sorting out corsets. Women's corsets. Women were still wearing corsets, and most of their precious possessions were sewn in corsets. And in no time at all did I fill a bucket full of jewellery. And then, of course, I had to fold these corsets. Normally, you had to not only sort these clothes, but you had to. You had to straighten the jackets, even though they were jackets. You had to fold them up and make bundles of, I can't remember, 6 or 12. You had to bundle these up, and you had to put your number on, because it all had to be checked over. You put your own number on who actually did this bundle, and this was handed in to another prisoner from our group, who was checking these bundles and checking how many bundles you had made during a certain period. And I think, I can't remember, but there was a quota that you had to make during a period of time. And once your quota was done, very often you disappeared. In fact, what you did is you went to the end of the barrack and hid behind a pile of clothes. And you probably stayed there until the end of the shift, if you managed to do your quota. I can't remember what the quota was now, but because it depended how quickly you could find what exactly you were sorting. If you were sorting men's jackets and you found enough jackets, yes, but if you didn't find enough and you had to make your quota, you had to rush around and perhaps ask people to bring more stuff in from the big, big pile that was outside so that you could find more jackets and make up your quota, because you could be punished if you didn't make up your quota. So basically this was the sort of work that we were doing.
Being in this relatively... Just going to go on from there, Kitty, to just ask you about how you could organize things. Yeah. Tell us about the physical difference between the main camp at Auschwitz and the Kanada
compound. I think what struck me so much when we approached the Kanada compound was the tidiness of the place. It all seemed very new. The buildings, the crematoria buildings and the chimneys certainly looked very new. The lawn was beautifully...
He's
answered it. We can start again.
Shall we ask him to unplug it? Just while we finish the interview.
I think he won't have a long conversation. Well, I see, because when he puts it down... Yes?
Once in...
No, you won't ring again, no.
Don't worry. Okay.
Right. No, I don't think so. Sorry? No.
You're on mobile.
Oh, you're mobile.
That would be embarrassing.
We have to start again, I think.
Yeah, we're starting.
I think what struck me, first of all, when we approached the Kanada compound was how new it looked, how tidy it looked. All of the structures looked new. Certainly the crematoria and the tall chimneys looked fairly new. Our living quarters looked new, and inside our barracks we seemed to have had new bunk beds. The only thing that looked old was this huge pile of clothes, but there was a flower bed and everything was very orderly. And at first we couldn't actually understand this, because it was such a contrast between this camp and Birkenau. Now Birkenau was always submerged in mud. There was just a sea of mud. In the summer it dried hard, but from July, August already to the whole of the winter and into the spring, people were actually sinking into the mud as far as their calves on their knees, because this area was actually lowland. It was the overflow of the tributary of the Vistula. It was called Zasole, behind the River Soa. And my mother remembered it as a fishing village, and it was actually lowland. And so the whole area was always muddy. It was never dry, and there was never a blade of grass, as of course it is today. It's all been grassed over. But in contrast, Canada had the most beautiful small lawn with flower beds. And this made us incredibly suspicious. We just couldn't fathom it. We couldn't work it out, what it was all about. We obviously realized that we are near the crematoria, but really what it meant, we didn't realize when we actually got there to sort out the clothes. The other problem was that we were not actually allowed to touch any of the goods that we were sorting. There was one closed hut or block, and that was known as the Fressbaracke. It was full of food. Food was rotting. Beautiful food, sausages, bread, name it, there was just everything there. And of course we actually didn't have any access to it, except the people who were actually sorting it. So people who were sorting food had access to food. People who were sorting clothes had access to food, which were not allowed to take. However, that is where we actually began to organize and barter and change food for clothes. And of course we realized that because there was this abundance of everything, and yet there was absolutely nothing in the other camps, and people were starving and they had no clothes and no shoes, some means had to be found to bring some of this wealth back into the camp. But of course it was strictly forbidden. However, we did have a very good couple for a change, because we were by then so known as a privileged group, and we had this couple who negotiated with one of the SS women in charge of our group to take some just ordinary third-rate clothing, which they wouldn't need for transportation to Germany, to be allowed back into the camp. So ever so often we used to take a cart of clothes back into the camp, and at the same time we would smuggle valuables that we knew that could be used for bartering or saving other people's lives, which would take on our person. And very often I would go into the camp with a group and perhaps wear five or six layers of clothes and have pinned various objects on my back and smuggle these back into the camp. Of course, when we approached the camp, we were usually searched. As you went from one gate to another, there were so many different gates, and through the gates you were searched. But if you could just wear the clothes and not have anything loose, or certainly you couldn't carry anything, you could smuggle a few goods back into the camp. And this is how I managed to get stuff to my mother, which was absolutely invaluable, because at that time she had typhus and she had to be looked after. And these goods actually paid for that. And of course it eventually also paid, she paid with some of the goods to have our numbers included in the evacuation transport. In other words, she had our numbers included on a list of women who were to be evacuated. So this was a very, very useful exercise to be able to go into the main camp and bring something back for some of our friends.
You said how close you were to the crematoria, and I believe you witnessed a whole convoy of people going into the gas chambers. Can you describe that scene for us?
Yes, I would just like to explain perhaps a little bit about the hierarchy, the SS hierarchy in that section of the camp. Although we were 400 women, and there must have been about the same number of men, the only SS personnel that was in charge of this small section of the camp were four people. One SS person in charge of the crematorium, and then there were three others who were in charge of the actual goods that were being sorted out. They were checking the goods and checking that the quotas were being met, and checking the jewelry that was being handed in. I don't know how much was lost before it was actually handed over to the banks, but there were only four people. They kept their own personnel down to the minimum. But we had one or two personnel who were particularly nasty, and because of course they patrolled outside the crematorium doors. Now where we had a direct view of the people that were being brought into this compound, and I'm talking about May 1944. And what we didn't realize at the time, they were preparing to bring in about 750,000 of Hungarian Jews between May and September 1944. And this is why this new group was formed, because they were expecting a lot of possessions to be sorted out, and there was an awful lot of activity. The first sign of anything untoward happening was the arrival of a transport, and women and children were separated from the men, and they were sitting in a small wood which was just across from our barrack. Now, I was on night shift, and therefore I actually could observe what was going on during the day. If I had been on day shift and I had been locked up inside the barrack, I would have seen very little. But because I was on night shift, and I very often actually slept during my shift when I made my quota, I could actually observe what was going on during the day. And what I observed was the following. Women and children would be sitting in the little wood. Children would pick flowers, the women would sit and picnic and give children some food or drink, which they brought with them, which they still had on them, small possessions. And a group of people would then be led into the low building, which my view was only of Crematorium 4. People were led into the Crematorium 4, and you heard a sort of a muffled sound. And then from one of the windows from my barrack, I could see one person walking up a ladder in very often either in a white suit or just in a uniform, who wore a gas mask. He walked up the ladder, he would empty a tin into an opening at the top of the at sort of a skylight at the top of the ladder. He would empty the tin, and you would run down the ladder very quickly and close the opening. Soon after that, you would hear a muffled sound. You couldn't hear a lot of noise, but you did hear a muffled sound. And occasionally you could hear more than a muffled sound. You could actually hear screams. Very often, after that, there was a pause, and you could see smoke coming out of the chimney of Crematorium 4. And perhaps a while later, you'd actually see activity at the rear of the crematorium. That's when you would see the men bringing out ash, which was dumped at the back of Crematorium 4. There was a pond, and they simply dumped ash into this pond. Now, what I couldn't understand is that the people sitting in the wood were totally calm. They had no idea that the people that had gone in front of them were already dead. They simply had no idea. They saw us well-dressed. We were well-dressed by that time, of course. Very often, we were sunbathing on the lawn in front of summer during 1944. Very often, we would actually play games, simply to distract ourselves from the sight that we were seeing, so that we tried to brainwash ourselves if we didn't see what was going on. It wasn't very often that we actually saw some violence. It did happen. I did witness some violence, which they tried very hard to keep everything very calm. And so people sitting around waiting to go into the gas chamber didn't actually know that they were going to die. Possibly that there would have been panic, and therefore everything was kept to absolute order. But there were instances of violence. I have seen when a child picked flowers, for instance, the SS man called, we used to call him the Schleppe, the Blinder, who incidentally I went to a trial in 1988, and he was eventually convicted on 5 counts of murder and sentenced to life. But this man, I watched him pick up a child at one point and smash it against a brick wall in front of its mother. And he also once did an appalling thing. He was known as the William Tell of Auschwitz. He would place tins on prisoners' heads, also the male prisoners, and shoot at these tins until he actually missed and killed them. One day, some women and children were sitting in the wood just across from Crematorium 4 and across from our barrack, and one child begged for water. Someone from our compound actually threw a bottle of water, which was forbidden. He picked up this child, he threw it up in the air, and he impaled it on his bayonet, because he had a fixed gun with a bayonet at the end of it. He then demanded to know who the person was that handed over the bottle, and threatened that if the person was not going to come forward, every fifth person during our roll call would be killed. And eventually the person owned up and just got away with a punishment. Wasn't actually killed, because he wasn't actually in charge of people. He wasn't in charge, it was just totally gratuitous killing on his part. He was simply in charge of the effects, he was in charge of clothes. He was not in charge of prisoners, but he took it upon himself to be violent towards the people that were going to die anyway, which was almost against rules, because they tried to keep everything incredibly calm and secretive, so that people didn't know what was going to happen to them.
Did you and the other girls know fully what you were witnessing? Did you understand fully what you were witnessing?
We certainly saw so much that in the end we couldn't take it in. It was very difficult to actually take it in, what was happening, and so we tried to blot it out. We tried to think, but it wasn't actually happening, because if we took it in, I think most of us would have just gone insane. So we tried to pretend we didn't see it, and we tried to pretend we're elsewhere, and we tried to make music and distract ourselves. But of course, you couldn't. You heard the sound. You sometimes heard noise. You sometimes heard crying. You sometimes heard screams. But of course, most of the time, you saw the smoke and the fire. And you also realized that people were being, not only were they taken to the crematorium, but the capacity of the crematoria at that stage could no longer cope with the arrivals of 750,000 people. So many of the executions took place at the back of the wood in pits. And we saw men gathering brushwood where they had to make great big fires, and they actually killed people at the back of the wood, of the birch wood. So we couldn't take it in for a long, long time. But of course, we were there for 8 months, and we saw it day in, day out.
So you were in a very good position to actually get some sense of the scale of what was going on.
We knew exactly of the scale, because we saw the mountain of clothes. The amount of shoes and the amount of clothes that we saw gave us an idea of how many people were actually being killed. My estimate, I don't know if it is accurate, would have been between 10 and 20,000 people a day during the height of the killing period of August, July 1944. There were also transports from other camps that were liquidating Majdanek and everywhere where the Red Army was approaching. So they were liquidating camps as well. And many of the prisoners who survived these camps for a very long time went straight to the gas chambers, and they knew where they were going. To them, it was common knowledge. They, as soon as they saw the camp, they knew what it was all about. We had girls from a sort of Canada commander from Majdanek who came in, and they told us, we were in Majdanek doing what you're doing, and we are now going to the gas chambers. They knew exactly where they were going. And of course, we knew ourselves that our time was going to run out. If there were no more transports, they were going to dispose of us, because we were direct witnesses of what was actually happening. We were direct witnesses of murder. So we realized that we were definitely next on the list, and it was a very great surprise that I was actually evacuated from Canada. It was I at one stage I didn't know if the other Canada girls had survived. It was only after the war that I met a girl that was actually sleeping with me in the same bunk.
Did you have any contact with members of the Sonderkommando at that time?
The Sonderkommando was totally isolated. They were not allowed to have any contact whatsoever with us. We never had any contact with men anyway. We had no contact.
Talking about the Sonderkommando.
Oh, yeah.
So, we'll
pick
up on that. And then perhaps we could talk about the blowing up of the sanatorium by the bill.
The what?
There was a revolt.
Oh, yes.
They spike a lot of expensive metal-sonic matters, actually. Apparently, these are people who transfer. Was it from my darling? They were Red Army.
You were telling us about the sonic matters.
I never remember any contact whatsoever with the Sonderkommando, because the men of the Sonderkommando were isolated. They lived around the crematoria. They were not allowed to mix with anyone else, maybe with the men, but of course men and women were not allowed to talk to each other or have any contact whatsoever. So the thing is, we never ever had any contact whatsoever. We did see them from the distance. I saw men of the Sonderkommando emptying ash and walking around the crematorium 4. My view actually was only of crematorium 4. I couldn't see crematorium 3 and 2 because although we were in a small camp of 30 barracks, the two living barracks were fenced off, and so we were actually enclosed in a very, very confined to a very, very small space, and apart from walking to our barrack to work and walking back we were taken to the barrack to work and taken again back to our living quarters. We didn't have the free run of the small area. We only had the run of the two barracks. And so therefore, my only view was to crematorium 4 and the sauna and the wood of where people were sitting waiting to go into crematorium 4.
Actually, before we talk about the revolt, maybe you could just talk about the escape of
Marla. Yeah, yes. Of course, I don't know the full story. Mm-hmm. We had in Birkenau several girls who were known as messenger girls or Läuferinnen, because of course there was no telephone communication and the commandants needed contact from one camp to the other. These messenger girls were usually sent from one camp to the other to take messages to the different that was actually contact between the SS, the ruling hierarchy. I don't think it meant contact between prisoners. They were simply sent with these messages to the different camps. One of the Läuferinnen and one of the messenger girls was a girl called Marla. She was born in Poland but came from Belgium to the camp. She was greatly respected and she did an enormous amount of good work for the prisoners, for her friends, and she saved a lot of people. And she had contact with the men because, of course, she walked from one camp to another. And I think she had a boyfriend. Being a privileged prisoner, she actually managed to have a relationship. And I think her boyfriend was also some privileged prisoner. And they decided they could just about escape because they had access to uniforms. And I believe they were both dressed in German uniforms, I don't know, SS uniforms, that they managed to obtain. And they simply walked out of the camp. They were free for about a week. But unfortunately, they were recaptured in my own hometown of Bielsko. They were brought back and tortured for many, many weeks and months because they wanted to know how they got out, how they got their uniforms, and what contacts they had outside, because they had help outside the camp, because you couldn't actually escape unless you had some help from outside, because people would have been afraid to hide them. So they obviously had some contact with some resistance movement, and so they were interrogated for many, many weeks. Eventually, she was condemned to die, and she was brought in to the main camp, and I think I was already in Canada, but we were all recalled back to the camp because we were to witness the execution. And she was she had already been tortured and she could no longer stand, and she was put on a little hand cart and wheeled to the gallows, and they tied her up on the gallows with the hands, and I can't exactly recall how she was tied up. And at the last minute she got up and said, "Oh, you're all going to die anyway. Don't worry, your end is very close," or something like this. And she cut her wrist with a razor blade, and they never actually managed to kill her. She killed herself. She committed suicide. And that was sort of her execution. And she died before she was hung.
Was the hope with Mrs. Bates that they could get word to the outside of what was happening in the camp?
Well, of course, the main object of escapes was to let the world outside know what was going on. What we did know is that there was a resistance movement, but we didn't quite know who they were. We didn't know of their work, because there were so many informers that you couldn't trust anyone. And of course, everything was incredibly secretive. But I believe the main object of the exercise was to actually inform the world of what was going on. And there were one or two successful escapes, but of course, as we know today, nothing actually happened to save the inmates of Auschwitz.
That's about the revolt in Auschwitz, which resulted in the blowing up of some of the crematoria.
While I was sorting clothes in Canada, we gathered an enormous amount of jewellery and dollars and money. Well, money was obviously to us of no value whatsoever. We used it as toilet paper. But jewellery, we realised it could just come in handy, and it might be useful for the resistance movement, which we didn't know who they were, but we figured it must have been most of the men. We didn't realize that some of the women were involved in the resistance. They were part of the resistance movement. But there was one of our girls who was associated with this resistance movement. We didn't know at the time, because, as I said, no one would divulge who these people were. However, we did realize that we must sabotage and we must not hand in a lot of the loot that we've actually found. So much of it we buried, because we couldn't keep it, and it was strictly forbidden to keep even the tiniest little single ring or watch, and it was much too dangerous, so we never kept anything. But we tried to bury some of it, and what we didn't, we tried to hand to the men. So on one occasion I had found, I don't know, a whole pile of diamonds and jewellery, which I was determined not to hand in. Word got round that a group of men were coming round to do some work in the camp, and I thought, well, this would be a very good opportunity for me to hand some of this stuff to the men, because it was even too dangerous to take a lot of stuff into the main camp, because you were searched, and if an item like this had been found, well, it most certainly would have been killed on the spot, and not even taken as far as the gas chamber. So it was much too dangerous to keep anything or take anything to the main camp. But I thought I could do something and hand it to the men. And this is what I did. I managed to pass near a group of men and drop it into their soup, because they just happened to pass by and carry a great cauldron of soup, and I dropped this into this bucket of soup, and at the same time I tried to sort of tell the men there was something at the bottom, and they nodded, so they did obviously realize there was something there, and this is how some of the stuff found itself eventually into the factory where they were producing explosives. And one of the girls who worked in the factory, I think she was one of the girls that I remember from the Canada, she carried some of the explosive powder. She smuggled some of this powder back into the camp. Now, somehow these explosives had to be purchased, and much of it was purchased by the loot that came into Canada, that we managed to pass on to the men, who in turn passed it to the resistance, who in turn passed it to the girls who worked in ammunition factories. Eventually, something drastic did happen. We didn't quite know what. We knew something was going to happen. Transports were no longer arriving, and there was a rumor that the whole area, especially the area of the crematoria, was going to be razed to the ground. Hess, the commandant, came back with an order from Berlin in September, and this leaked out. They were going to bomb the whole area and raise it to the ground and kill all the inmates. So we knew our days were numbered. Now the men in the crematorias on the commando, they knew that their time was up because they were forever being exchanged. They were killed off and a new commando formed, and they were determined that this time something was going to happen, particularly as we knew no transports were no longer arriving. They had to liquidate the camp, and news leaked out that the front, the Russian front, wasn't all that far away. It happened on October the 7th of 1944, where we heard a lot of rumble. And of course our first thought was that we were being bombed, because we knew there had been an order for bombing, and we threw ourselves to the ground. But in the very next moment, we, from our hut, saw the chimney of Crematorium 4 topple to the ground. Of course, couldn't understand this at first. And then, almost immediately, there was shooting from all sides, and we threw ourselves to the ground. Waiting. Oh, there was a command actually to lie on the ground, flat on the ground, spread-eagled on the ground, and a motorized division of the SS moved in, and we realized that wasn't actually a bombing; it was an uprising. That was really actually the first time we realized what had happened, and it was actually the act of four girls who made this possible by smuggling in the explosives that destroyed Crematorium 4, and of course it saved enormous amount of lives, because they could no longer continue with the program of killing people off, because it had disrupted their routine. But of course they killed all the people involved, and there was a huge interrogation. Because they had a whole Gestapo headquarters in Auschwitz, and they all came up to Canada, and we were all interrogated.